We'll be talking science, research, and all things connected with it coming up next here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Bassam Shakashiri, UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry, William T. Evu Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin IDEA, and Director of the Initiative for Science Literacy. And I know we want to talk about fireworks, but of course we'll talk about other things as well as we visit with him. Certainly, if you have a question about science or science research or education, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. And Bassam, welcome back.
Happy to be with you, Larry.
You know, it's interesting to know that today, this may be a first for Wisconsin Public Radio. We have my two guests are both fellows in the Wisconsin Academy of Science, Arts, and Letters. You and David Marinesses as well, and there are only 100 that can belong to that.
That's right. Only 100 can be elected. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that's pretty cool to have two fellows on the same program. That's great. Well, let's talk about those fireworks for just a minute. You know, we've got and you and I have watched this Rhythm and Booms fireworks show. Hundreds of thousands of people come to it. And what can you tell us about the chemical reactions that are involved with these beautifully colored and often loud fireworks?
Well, you know, a lot of chemical transformations are taking place in a very interesting and choreographed way. It is really an art to put these fireworks together. We enjoy spectacular displays of color, sound, and a little bit of smoke, too. But it's dark. We can't see the smoke very well. Fireworks generate three very noticeable forms of energy. Bright light, sound energy, and heat. Mm-hmm. We don't feel the heat because we're too far away from the combustion reaction that's taking place. The tremendous booms that we hear at ground level are the result of a very rapid release of energy into the air, and that causes the air to expand faster than the speed of sound, and this produces a shockwave, what we call a sonic boom.
Mm-hmm.
The colors, you asked about the colors.
Yeah.
The colors are produced by heating metal salts, such as calcium chloride or sodium chloride or a whole bunch of other combinations, and they emit characteristic colors. The atoms of each of these metals absorb energy, and then they release it in the form of light of a specific color. So when we make fireworks, I don't make fireworks. When professionals make fireworks, they put the salts, these metal salts, into what they call stars. Stars are small clay or dough-like clumps of or cubes of about 3 to 4 centimeters in diameter. You know, 3 to 4 centimeters is about how many inches, Larry?
It's not very much.
Not very much, but you know. And when they're ignited, the stars produce both sound and light effects, and the appearance of the firework is determined by what goes into the stars. And they're made by hand, very carefully, and they're packed into cardboard compartments within the firework shell. Then they await ignition by a time delay fuse. It's really an art, as I said before, and professionals are very good at this. It is a dangerous and hazardous profession because a lot of things can go wrong. We're talking about chemicals igniting and burning very, very rapidly. And that's why it's important for all of us who enjoy fireworks to obey the safety rules. The reason that states and the federal government have laws about safety is for our own protection and the protection of the people around us. So I urge everyone in our listening audience to enjoy the beautiful displays of color, sound, and music come Saturday night here in the Madison area, but let the professionals do it. So, you know, fireworks, just a couple of other things about fireworks. They are classified as both low and high explosives. The initial lift, you have to get the star up there. The initial lift charge that sends the firework into the sky is a low explosive. But when it gets up there, then you get very rapid detonation, and that's what generates the sonic boom that we talked about. We have on our website a display, an explanation of how these fireworks work.
Cool.
And so I invite everyone in the listening audience to visit our website. In the upper right corner, you'll see a display, a graphic display of fireworks.
Mm-hmm.
The website is www.scifun.org. Scifun.org. And by the way, Larry, the Wisconsin State Journal tomorrow is in their edition tomorrow. They're featuring a story about fireworks, and I've been a consultant to them. And on their website, they have an interactive program that anyone, any kid of any age can work with and look up how fireworks are put together, how they're detonated. And all you have to do is go to the Wisconsin State Journal website. And there is a feature on the right-hand side of the page. It's called Check This Out. Check this out, and you'll see a picture of fireworks, and then you can learn a lot as to how these booms come about and how the fireworks work.
Oh, that's great. And obviously, on the 28th will be the big one here in Madison, but obviously as well across the country on July 4th, you'll hardly find a place in Wisconsin where you won't see fireworks.
Indeed, it's a tremendous celebration, and I urge everyone to enjoy the vivid display of colors, but also, Larry, to remember what these explosions are really all about.
Yeah.
They are about our Independence Day.
Mm-hmm.
They are about the celebration of the Declaration of Independence. And there's a little booklet, actually, that UW-Madison has put together some years ago that I distribute around this time of the year and actually throughout the year to every student in my class, in my chemistry class. It's called American Trilogy. It has three parts to it, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is the Declaration of Independence. The second one is the U.S. Constitution. And the third one is the Bill of Rights.
Yeah.
I know the Bill of Rights is part of the Constitution, but it's called out so that and it's very important for each of us to remember what these great celebrations are all about.
Yeah.
They're
it's
about
great.
The freedom that we enjoy in this country. They're about the society that we belong to and the great heritage and traditions that we have. And if you find me excited about this, Larry, I am because throughout this year, I'm celebrating the 50th anniversary of my arrival in the United States.
Wow.
And I'm very proud to be a U.S. citizen. I'm very grateful for being a U.S. citizen. And I want people to learn about science, to learn about fireworks, and to be remembering what these displays are all about.
Well, you make some excellent points there. And we can talk some more about fireworks or take some questions about them, but we'll also take other questions as well. I wanted to ask you about the RAND Corporation just issued a report saying we still lead the world in science and technology, even though I think other reports say we are at high risk of losing our preeminence in that field. And as the federal government convenes a science and technology summit, what is your opinion on these, I guess, contradictory reports that you see?
Well, they sound contradictory, but they really reinforce each other. Again, this is, to me, an important feature of the freedom that we enjoy in our country, the freedom of not only freedom of speech, freedom of expression, all kinds of freedom. So the RAND Corporation has come up with this report issued earlier this month that challenges the accepted formula and advances that are being made overseas. and they say that the U.S. is falling behind. The fact is, science has no geographic boundaries. Advances in science and technology can benefit people around the globe. And what the RAND Corporation is saying is that we have to put together effective national policies that will serve not only our students, but also serve the rest of the population in terms of what goes on in science and in technology. So whenever knowledge is created, as I said, it can serve everybody. But the federal government, the U.S. Congress, and the president have enacted laws now, an act called the American Competes Act, that calls attention to the fact that other countries are catching up with us in terms of advances in science and technology. And there are concerns about our ability to compete economically on the global scene. So, you know, Larry, science and technology are the engines that drive our economy.
Right.
So part of this law that was enacted last year calls for a summit on science and technology. And this summit will be held in August at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory. It is organized by the President's Office of Science and Technology Policy. And its goals are to examine the health and direction of the U.S. scientific and technological enterprise, to review the progress that has been made that got us this far, and to identify challenges, including some of the ones that are mentioned in the RAND Corporation report. But more importantly, to develop policies that will keep us competitive, but also will contribute to the effective use of science and technology in serving humanity.
We have some callers online. By the way, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And let's take a call. Ruth in Madison, you're up. Ruth, thanks for calling. Hi.
Thank you. Hi. I usually watch Rhythm and Booms from the opposite side of the lake, not being one to want to get messed up in the crowd. Mm-hmm. And I just see this whole cloud envelop the northeast side of Madison. And I can't help but wonder how much of that is toxic heavy metals.
Huh.
And you know, how dangerous is it in the long run to people?
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point. It relates to the safety issue that I raised before. So the amounts of salts that are used in putting the fireworks together, it's relatively small. If you are in the immediate vicinity, if you're sitting right under the firework as it explodes, and you breathe some of what's coming down, then that's not a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the organizers of Rhythm and Booms and all other responsible organizers of firework displays, they set them off in an area separated from the audience. So mm-hmm. even if you are within 100 or 200 yards of where the fireworks are being displayed, then I think that should be okay. You're right. I have watched the Rhythm and Booms both from across the lake and from the location itself. And you do see this cloud of smoke. That's what it is, because all of these combustion reactions produce light, sound, heat, energy, but then the material itself is particulate material, and it forms this smoke. It'll blow off if we have a small breeze that helps. But the amounts that are used in fireworks, relatively speaking, are not dangerous, but it's something we should keep an eye on.
Yeah.
Well, but they set off so many thousands of them.
Yeah. Yeah, they set off a lot.
Well, that's the effect that people are looking for, right?
Yeah.
Rapid, successive explosives, stars, palms, different shapes. Yeah.
Thanks for calling, Ruth. Appreciate it. Jim in Goleta, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question regarding global warming. Just wondering, does all the stored solar energy that makes up our oil, gas, and coal reserves, when that energy is burned and released, besides the CO2 and the greenhouse effect, does that thermal energy that's released from the burning of the fuel, does that contribute to global warming that we know of, or is it insignificant?
It is relatively insignificant. What contributes the most is the formation of carbon dioxide, which then puts a blanket, so to speak, not allowing the heat to escape into the environment. So it's mostly the carbon dioxide that is. There are other greenhouse gases that do the same thing. Carbon dioxide, of course, is the result of the combustion processes of gasoline, oil, any oil-based chemical product, and but it is important to keep an eye also. By the way, Jim, it is the heat generated from these combustion reactions that we use we use it to do all kinds of things that we want to do. So the combustion reaction in the inside the car engine makes the piston move. So you change chemical energy into mechanical energy. But the direct answer to your question is that the it's the carbon dioxide that's the main culprit.
All right.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Bassam Shakashiri, UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry and William T. Evu Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin IDEA. Our guest here as we talk science and science research on the IDEAS Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. When you phone in with your question or comment, you will hear the melodious voice of Jim Packard, our producer. Always great to have him with us. He is indispensable, as a matter of fact, to the program in more ways than one, I can tell you that.
And he's a very nice man, too.
Yeah, nice guy as well. Bassam Shakashiri, our guest, as we talk science with him, give us a call at 800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Greg in Watertown is up next. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Larry. Say, I was wondering, our local group, Sustain Jefferson, built a FEMA stratified downdraft gasifier. It's a type of stove that creates hydrogen and carbon monoxide from biomass, and we get like 20% hydrogen, 20% carbon monoxide, and about 60% nitrogen, the background atmospheric gas, and the syngas that is produced in the stove. And we use that in an internal combustion engine, and I'm wondering about the proper stoichiometric relationship between the syngas going into the internal combustion engine and the air that we use for the combustion process. And I'm also wondering about how much heat is being consumed in the stove to create the hydrogen and carbon monoxide from the water vapor and carbon dioxide in the initial pyrolysis or burning chamber.
Very good questions, Greg. Let me say before I get your answers, you are of course doing this in a very safe way because you're producing carbon monoxide, and that's deadly poisonous. You know that, right?
Oh yes, we do, and we take great precautions and are aware of that. But thank you for the warning.
Yes, and it's just an alert to you and anyone else who might contemplate doing this. Gasification and synthesis gas—that's what syngas is—is an industrial process, long known, and it is an efficient process. Not 100% efficient. You know, you can get heat loss in just about any process. So, actually, I have a kind of a one-page handout on exactly the very same questions that you asked that I distribute to my class. And what I will do, Greg, is I will post it on my website in the next couple of days. You just go to the website. Every time, Larry, you know, after your program, we put a summary on the website.
Yes.
So if you go to my website and click on scifund.org and then click on Science on the Radio, in the next couple of days, I'll post that with the detailed information and the references that you might want to look up to.
All right. Great.
Great. Thanks for the help.
You bet. Thanks a lot for calling. Betty in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Betty.
Yes. Assuming that Rhythm and Boom, say, might be a war zone, you know, that what is happening in Iraq then with the explosions, what is the effect on Iraq and the effect on the atmosphere? What sort of pollution is generated over these past, 4 or 5 years? And the airplanes and all of that cumulatively, what do you estimate is the effect?
Boy, that one you probably don't have a definitive answer on, Bassam, but you want to take a guess?
We always have to be careful how we use results that we learn about from advances in science and in technology. There's no doubt whatsoever that weapons that involve explosives and combustion reactions produce, contribute to air pollution. It's a question of scale. What we're talking about in rhythm and booms and other fireworks displays is relatively small, very small. In warfare, that's a different story altogether. And it's a different story that involves the people who are setting them off, the people who are targeted, and so on. So that's a very good question, Betty, and it's a question that we should all think about as we contemplate what we want to do in proper use of science and technology. But you're right. There is more production chemicals that contribute to air pollution, and the temperature of the environment that this is in is also a factor. You know, it's very hot there. It's mostly desert. And how the winds blow to dissipate what's put up there, all are important factors.
Thanks for calling, Betty. Appreciate it. Roger and Gordon, it's your turn next. Hi, Roger.
Hi there. I've got a question. I was listening about fireworks and heavy metals.
Yes.
And the comment made about the wind is dissipating those. Most of the fireworks that I've seen are shot over water, over lakes, for safety purposes, which I understand. But then we had the particulate heavy metals going into the water. We've already got a problem with lead fishing tackle being in the our waters and killing loons and other birds. You know, is there a problem with those particulates of heavy metals falling into our waters? Because they don't dissipate like they do in the air.
Yeah.
Well, what we're talking about are relatively small amounts of the metal ions, the metal salts, calcium chloride, potassium nitrate, sodium chloride, table salt, and so on. Unless the body of water that you're talking about has a small volume, the effect is negligible. And I'm not dismissing this. I'm just saying that it is not a major safety issue. It is a safety issue, but it's not a major safety issue. So I suspect that if one were to analyze the waters in the area, say, the northern part of Lake Mendota, I don't think you'll be able to detect increases in the amounts of salt, of the salts we're talking about in the water, because the amounts are relatively small. Unlike what we do in the wintertime, Larry and Roger, in the Madison area, we put a lot of salt on the roads to melt the ice, and then the runoff takes that salt into the lakes, and that
is far greater.
That's not good. That contributes to lowering the oxygen amounts that are in the lake. It affects aquatic life and so on. So this is a different scale.
Yeah. Thanks for calling, Roger. Gene in Ashland is up next. Gene, hello to you.
Hello. I'm not happy with all the things that go banging. We have heard of all these little scooters and automated wheelchairs that operate on charged batteries. But we have heard of the scooters and these little vehicles that can run on compressed air and carry compressed air tanks. And we've heard of them being shooed away from gas stations because all they want to do is draw on the compressed air. But how practical is this? What would be required to operate a vehicle on this? And how is that compression, that pressure, how is it safe?
Yeah.
As long as you have proper valves to get the air out, the compressed air out and so on, I think it should be fairly safe. Of course, if you let it out too fast, then you move faster and you can have a rocket. So I think everything is calibrated carefully and the safety valves are there and so on. I think it's for the non-motorized vehicles you're talking about, like a wheelchair or something like that, I think that's fine, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, with your question about science and science research as we visit with Bassam Shakashiri. The number to call, we'll get you on pretty quickly, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. And you can email us, too, at talk@wpr.org. And, Bassam, you wanted
to... I wanted to say something about the bangs because, you know, Gene said something about the bangs and so on. And the loud bangs, you know, they affect not only people, but they affect animals.
Yeah.
In our case, you know, we have to take the dogs away and, and put them away because they get very, very scared. And so, again, I urge people to take care not only of themselves, but of their pets as they go out to enjoy the fireworks and those displays. And so be mindful that pets also have to be taken care of.
Yeah. And a friend, actually, some friends who were watching the fireworks and the dog, they had the dog with them, and that was a big mistake. They were quite a ways away, but the dog still ran off and it eventually got killed. So it's something you want to take care of. Jim in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Jim. Jim, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I've noticed an optical illusion concerning fireworks, and I'd like to know whether other people have noticed that or whether it's something strange with me. When a star shell goes off, as I look at the fireworks, it seems as if all the streamers are coming toward me, but I know intellectually that half of them must be going in the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. Is it common that the brain would interpret that explosion in that fashion or not?
It's very interesting that you ask this, Jim, because part of the research and development work that I'm doing right now with two of my colleagues as we develop a series of chemical demonstrations that are colorful, we're looking not only at what the eye sees, what's in front of the eye, but we're trying to get a handle on what happens after this light signal gets to the eye and what happens in terms of the perception and so on. So that's a very, very timely question on your part. And I don't know the exact answer. Maybe somebody in the listening audience knows, but this is an area that I'm looking at right now. How do we perceive things? How do we perceive the different colors? Is something going away from us or coming at us? Very good question, Jim.
Okay.
Tell you what, you're going to have to, when you come up with some findings on that, Bassam, you're going to have to share those with us. That's pretty interesting
stuff. In fact, in the next couple of days, I might be able to post something on the website, too.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks, Jim and Wausau. How about Jim and Mequon? Your turn. Hi, Jim.
Yes, real pleasure. You know, you guys are the only people that have a show like this, so I really want to applaud you and your wonderful guest here today. My question real quickly, though, is... if I burn a pound of gasoline octane in my car, a pound, not a gallon, does that actually produce more than a pound of carbon dioxide? Of course, it goes to the issue of global warming, but you know, I'm just looking at hydrogen and oxygen, the different weights. Is that really the case? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Wait, Jim. Are you there? So you burn a pound of what now?
Gasoline.
Of gasoline, and you want to compare that to a pound of what?
No, carbon dioxide, CO2.
He's saying if you burn a pound of gasoline, is the result
you produce carbon dioxide?
But would you produce a pound of it?
That's
the question.
I see. That's a no is the answer because this is actually a topic in chemistry. We teach this. This is looking at the ratios of combination of different substances, in this case gasoline, which is a mixture of hydrocarbons burning, which is a chemical reaction with oxygen gas. And you can actually write a chemical equation with the correct identities of the different chemicals involved in there. And then depending on what the chemical formulas for the different substances are, you can calculate how much of each substance is formed. So there is not a one-to-one correspondence between a certain mass of a combustible material and the amount of carbon dioxide. For one thing, it depends how many carbon atoms are in the gasoline or whatever it is that you're burning. Each carbon atom is going to combine with two oxygen atoms to give you carbon dioxide. That's the chemical formula for carbon dioxide. So that's a good question. That's what the kind of question we drill our students to look at. It's a part of chemistry called stoichiometry. I've avoided using the word, but you want to look at the stoichiometric relationships between the reactants and the products.
But it's not a one-to-one.
Not one-to-one.
I know it's not one-to-one, but my contention would be that because oxygen is heavier than hydrogen, significantly heavier, that you're going to have two oxygen atoms grasp a hold of every carbon atom, and as a result, you're going to produce more carbon dioxide, greater weight, than that original pound of gasoline.
Okay.
Well, you're going to produce not only carbon dioxide, you're going to produce water vapor. I mean, that's what a complete combustion reaction will give you. And so we just assume that the gasoline is made up of one hydrocarbon, okay? Mm-hmm. Let's just assume that it is octane.
Okay.
Octane is 8 carbon atoms that are in it, and so you calculate the mass, the so-called molecular mass of octane, and then you burn that completely, and you compare that to how much the mass of the carbon dioxide that you get, and you're going to get for every a mole, what we call it, a mole, every unit of mass of the octane, and has 8 carbons in it, you're going to get 8 carbon dioxides. So in that sense, you're right. You're generating more carbon dioxide, but the weight of carbon dioxide is different than the weight of the octane. Okay?
I gotcha. Thanks for calling, Jim. Appreciate it. Eric in Cumberland. Your turn. Hi, Eric.
Hi. See, I love your show. Thanks. I listen to it all the time.
Thank you.
And I love your guest. I'm a hobbyist fireworks manufacturer, a licensed manufacturer, and I just wanted to correct a couple of things. The doctor mentioned sodium chloride, and that's something that we don't use. Even though it's got the sodium atom for the yellow, it's too hygroscopic. And you can't store fireworks with something that's that hygroscopic. But I just also wanted to mention, for things like green and red and blue, we use barium nitrate for the green and strontium nitrate or strontium carbonate for the red, and copper compounds for the blue. And I think, you know, I thought about this many times, too, because I'm a biologist by training, and I think if it lands on the land, the byproducts of the combustion, yeah. I believe that just goes into the soil as a combustion product, and I'm not sure, we'd have to do some soil testing and so forth, but I think it's pretty safe, because the plants, if they can't take up something like barium hydroxide or barium carbonate from the combustion product, that'll just sit in the soil, I would believe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Eric, thank you for your comments. The I think the question was about inhaling it, and as well as what.
Oh, that's a different story.
Yeah, as well as going into the water. So, no, of course, we're putting something into the environment. There's no question about it. So we're adding to it. But so what do you use to produce the yellow color if you don't use sodium chloride or sodium nitrate or something like that?
Well, some people use ultramarine.
Yeah.
And another one is shellac, which is an insect byproduct.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes calcium is the only choice, because that is also a reddish or a yellow orangish type.
Right.
Flame test, if you did the flame test with that. But yellow is a hard one, and some people just stay away from it because of the cost of the
materials, you
know, products and things. Now, in China, though, I think they have a lot of their fireworks are subsidized by the government because it's such a big exporter that they export.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not exactly sure about all the different yellow chemicals.
Well, we have a table in on the web on my website when you go to look at fireworks, and we show the different types of salts that are used to produce these different colors, and so including purple color, blue, green, yellow. We say it's sodium chloride. You're right; it is hygroscopic, so you have to be careful about it. But what you need, sodium is really characteristic metal ion that's used to produce the yellow.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of the effects that people see would be the charcoal, because that would, you know, like in a campfire, when you look at it, when it's just coals, it's kind of an orangish yellow. And a lot of some of the sparkly effects that you see, like with these long tails on a star, or some of these ascending comets that come up from the ground all the way up to the height where it bursts, like you were saying, a palm tree.
Yeah.
That is carbon, in a rich carbon formula.
Yes, there is a lot of charcoal in there. I didn't list all the components here this morning, but they're... But you're right. I mean, there's a lot of there are oxidizers, there are reducing agents, and so it's a fascinating area of science, actually. But the people who want to experiment with it should know exactly what they're doing, and I take it that you do.
Yeah, I think so as well. And Bassam, and of course, again, go online to your website and. What perfect timing. You've already got up there information on fireworks, what we've been talking about a little bit here and how they're made, and a whole lot more on that website, which is www.scifun.org, and that's scifun.org. So take a look at Bassam's website and learn a little bit more. And he's posting some other things as well relating to this show, and there's a lot of information on that. A lot of fun things that you can do as well from that website. Bassam, thanks again.
Thank you, Larry, and happy Independence Day to everyone.
To you as well. Thank you very much. Bassam Shakashiri, UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry, William T. Evu Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin IDEA, and a member, a fellow in the Wisconsin Academy of Science, Arts, and Letters. And so's our next guest coming up here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Marinese talks about his new book just coming out, Rome 1960, The Olympics That Changed the World. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.